Will Kreft joins the Plutopia podcast this time as we discuss his work in broadband and digital media. Will is CEO and founder of Hand Human and Digital, the first human talent ID registry. He hopes to address the challenges posed by deepfakes and the importance of content verification.
The threat of deepfakes is the number one thing that is capturing people's attention. And so why does what I do matter as a piece of the solution of the provenance, right? Of the source verification, of the verifiable credentials of the individual. We provide a free to search and match, persistent, no expiration date, unique identifier to identify the object of the person, and then a parent-child relationship to their replica, if they're with their consent. So while there are many companies who've raised quite a lot of money to use AI to detect deepfakes, there are fewer companies engaged in the necessary work around source verification of what is real and what is with consent in a world where fraudsters and scam artists and others have been appropriating, if not fully stealing, people's name, image, and likeness, their NIL, their name, image, and likeness, and sometimes their voice, which is even a more scary and dangerous area.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the latest episode of the Plutopia News Network podcast featuring John Lepkoski, that's me, my partner Scoop Sweeney, and our co-host Wendy Grossman. And our guest today is Will Kreft, who's CEO of Hand Human and Digital, a company that provides global talent identity resolution and verification, which we'll talk about. We'll find out what that's about. But Will's kind of a pioneer, having been the first employee at Wired Magazine, which is where I met him over 30 years ago. And if you're watching the video of this, you can see that I'm wearing a Wired Magazine hat. This hat was placed on my head the day that I met Will Kreft. Walked into the premises of Wired, and we just started jamming around and hanging out with people, and Will brought this hat over to me, and I think he put it directly onto my head. That was quite a day. I'm sure you remember every moment of that visit.
Yeah, well, what's our... folks don't realize or may not know is that we had an online connection before a IRL real life connection. So,
Yeah, that's true. We knew each other.
Right. Through the well. So the well, Whole Earth Electronic Link, located in Sausalito, California, was a offshoot of Whole Earth Review and I guess Point Foundation, right, John?
Right.
Back in those days. And
a huge influence on all of us, the whole Earth scene and Coevolution Quarterly and Whole Earth Magazine and Whole Earth Software Review, which turned a lot of people onto computers.
And before Wired started, there was both a private conference and then later a public conference. And the private conference was at least 6 months before the street date in January 93. Talking about, well, we invited Steve Levy and Bruce Sterling and you and so many other writers to that Wired.
And that's where you and I really first met, was in that private conference.
Yeah. The well-beings. And there was also a Doug Crockford multimedia conference, which we called Mucho Media. but folks like Doug and Linda Jacobson and others were all part of. But when multimedia was
Mucho Media is still there.
Thing, right? Don't get to the well that often anymore, but it was a different time where online communication, in my estimation, was less agenda-driven and less algorithmically driven for reaction and advertising. And there was no advertising. That's just the beautiful thing about it. It wasn't bowing down to the master of advertising, at least in those formative years.
No, but it was
and
expensive.
The well is still like it was. I mean, it hasn't really changed.
No, but the well was expensive. I mean, if you know, to get mass adoption, the internet probably needed advertising because not everybody can pay that kind of money every month.
It's good things and bad things for sure.
My recollection is that it cost, even if you were making a local call to dial in through the Wells modem, you were still paying $2 an hour to the well. And when I joined, I had to add long distance service onto that. So it was very difficult for me to spend much time on the well initially when I first got there. I later got Telnet access, which was a big change.
Yeah. Telnet as a game changer for those who remember. Absolutely. Then you're over to
That's how I accessed it. Now I use SSH, but it's the same thing. I mean, I'm basically logging in through a terminal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had a whole set of tools. I mean, I used something called PC Pursuit, which was a Sprint thing that allowed me to log in for, it was a flat rate of $30 a month, and then changed to CompuServe Packet Networks, which is a little bit faster and was like $2 an hour or something. I don't know. It was expensive back then. It's less expensive now. Now you can join the well for a flat rate. But the well membership has dwindled somewhat as so many people have moved to social media. On the other hand, there's still a core group of people on the well, including Wendy and I, who are pretty active.
Yeah.
Just need a host.
So, Will, how did you become part of Wired? How did you connect with them and get that gig?
Well, I got to know, I guess story begins when I was working for Apple at a little group called the Multimedia Lab in San Francisco. And my friend Linda Jacobson was friends with Howard Rheingold, probably through a Grateful Dead connection. I don't know exactly, but she was on the well and she was encouraging me to join and also to get to know the crowd there. So I think the Wired was a result of my tracing two Dutch magazines published by the same people. That would be the eventual Wired publishers, Louis Fazzetto and Dave Metcalf. Those magazines were called Electric Word and Language Technology in the late 80s, over the cusp of the early 90s. And I was trying to subscribe to the Electric Word because we thought it was back when magazines were kind of what we had before screens dominated our lives. The magazine was kind of a analog screen. And so I tried to get a subscription to Electric Word and got my check sent back to me. And I knew through that conference, that multimedia conference on the well, that Howard had mentioned them they had appeared in a Whole Earth review, a magazine review. So they did like topical things of zines and such. Well, not like Fact Sheet 5 per se, but a review of sorts. And so I asked Howard online, I said, do you know if Electric Word is still going on? I said, no, I think it's dead. So I then did some research on my own I knew there was another magazine out of Amsterdam published by a charming gentleman by the name of Willem Veldhoven. And that was a magazine called Mediamatic, and it's an arts collective that still to this day is on the banks of the Grand Canal in Amsterdam. And I had a terrific visit with him and a meal and a coffee couple of years back with Willem, but Willem knew knew the Electric Word crowd, knew pre-language technology, knew Lewis and Jane, and he informed me that they had moved back to the States because they were American expats living in the Netherlands at that time. And so a few more phone calls, because I was doing a little almost like a beat reporter trying to keep tracing a lead, got me to a publishing group out of Long Island, who then informed me that they had moved to San Francisco. And it was like, this is too strange. And then I got a phone number and I called up and Jane Metcalf answered, hi, we're Wired. I'm Jane, we're Wired. And they were down at 544 Second Street in the summer of 1991. And by that, I went down to see them in the summer of 91 in that little office space they shared with Randy Strickrod and several Mac and PC magazines in that building that were trade publications. And they had a space on the first floor. Randy let them co-office, a co-working space, like nothing like WeWork, but a shared office space with the folks from the two Daves, Dave Eggers and the other Dave, I forget his last name, but that's Mike Magazine. And Dave Eggers would later go on to be the novelist that folks know of as award-winning novelist, heartbreaking work of staggering genius and other works. But Mike Magazine was a can-do publication like Boing Boing, like our friends Mark and Carla and Gareth and others with the Boing Boing crowd publishing. In those early days of desktop publishing, where a lot of folks started magazines or zines and tried to find an audience for them. So we were sharing an office with Might Magazine and Randy Strickrod's computer magazine and Wired. But when I say we, the Wired folks were, I didn't join them officially until April 1st of 20, of 1992. But I did check in with them multiple times over the winter of 91, 92, just to see how things were going, and then offered to work for them for free in 1992. They did not believe me at first. They thought I was crazy, and they're probably a little right, or maybe a lot right. But they were just getting started, and they were just getting some funding from Charlie Jackson, Nicholas Negroponte, and just started on the journey of developing the not just a business a prototype and a business plan, but also a staffing and a launch go-to-market strategy as a magazine. So that's to answer your question. Those are kind of the threads of where it began, how it emerged through that detective work I did in 1991, and talking to Howard Rheingold, found out that and Willem Veldhoven found out that they had moved from Amsterdam to San Francisco, and then we kind of connected and hit it off and started talking, and by 92, they were thinking about moving forward faster and scaling and ramping up and going to market.
Weren't you kind of a prime mover at Hotwired, which was their online
Yeah,
service?
well, I mean, I guess that would begin to say that while I was at Wired, I was running the Wired Conference on the Well and also dealing with the ugly interface of American Online, which was used some software called Rain Man, which was very clunky to format Wired articles into. So I was in charge of formatting articles for America Online. And because it was they were the biggest dog in town, at least in 1992, 93, as far as growth areas of the walled gardens, the pre-Facebook, the pre-MySpace, Friendster, America Online had a captive audience. And they had, and then they we negotiated with America Online. Steve Case and Gene Villanueva and the folks at America Online to stand up a Wired conference or a Wired community of interest on America Online. And so I was running those things when the web exploded and the some students in Singapore had scanned copies of Wired the first year worth of magazines, because I remember it was 1993, like January 93, they start at Macworld. By that December, we were already starting to think about what's our online strategy beyond, above and beyond America Online and bulletin boards and the Well and things like that. So by December 93, we saw that the web, which it was growing in use, posting static images of the magazine scans online was happening for a kind of an ad hoc basis. And so we started planning to create the Hotwired online publication that December.
When I was working in IT in the Bay Area for Kaiser Permanente, Wired came out, and all of a sudden, everybody in the IT group started handing around this very tattered copy because no one had a subscription yet. But it made its way through dozens and dozens of hands, and I immediately had to subscribe. And I was amazed that Wired became like a big vacuum cleaner for talent was sucking up all these people and all these operations and incorporating it into Wired, it seemed. And that's what impressed everyone so much. Was that like a constant thing of looking for talented people in media to bring in, or did it just happen?
I think it just happened. I think there was some reaching out to folks. I knew when John Battelle came from the UC Berkeley publishing program, I was at Clay Felker, student of Clay Felker's, who was the dean of the journalism school at Berkeley, and kind of one of his like favorites over there. And Kevin Kelly came from Whole Earth, to your point about the acquisition of someone who was already involved. But that all happened actually before day one, before Macworld 1993. So a lot of that recruiting happened and outreach happened in the summer of 92. Just from the timeline and the perspective of what the chronology is or was. It was a heady time of like seeing how it would all come together on a shoestring, even though there was a little bit of seed money from Charlie Jackson, Nicholas Negroponte. There was still not much budget for the publishing, the printing, and the advertising trades they did to get. They did a trading, they did advertisements for hardware. There was a lot of bartering that went on. I think that was to their credit of a very scrappy entrepreneurial mindset of hustle and drive to make the most of what they had and work with what they had, which was still pretty lean, super lean operation in the early days.
So you mentioned to us that you had, sort of before getting to all this, you had a pre-internet brain. You want to expand on that a little bit? What was the pre-internet brain? I think I might have had one too.
Yeah, I'm happy to give my two cents about pre-internet brain. It's a kind of a tagline you see every so often. I miss my pre-internet brain. I've seen people repeat that. I think there was who's grew up in, I'm a aspirational Gen Xer right on the cusp, born in 64, late 64. 65 is the supposedly the cutoff of boomer to Gen X. I think that for folks of our generation who grew up in the era of post or like through Vietnam, post Watergate, early Reagan years, the rise of do-it-yourself media and punk rock, had a pre-internet brain, which was a little more like, to the sense of like, not everything was available in our pockets and at our fingertips at all time. That is where we are now. Whether it's for long-term effects of good and bad are still being studied. The results are in some cases, but the pre-internet brain that I speak of is that it was, I used to remember waiting in line for a new album release at a record store. Anybody else? Anybody? Like the day I knew when the new album was going to drop, it was announced in the magazine, and then I'd go to the record store and I would ask the clerk or the high fidelity moment of saying, do you know when the new Laurie Anderson is coming out or the new Talking Heads album is coming out or whatever? And they would say, it's going to be a Thursday. We should get a shipment in. And I remember going to wait in line for the doors to open to go buy that copy of that album. So my son who's 12 years old will never understand having to wait for media in exactly the same way. Now there are things do happen up to a calendar, there's schedules and things drop, you know, if we drop the new this or whatever, but there was a physicality of actually getting out of your house, going somewhere, waiting in line, doors open. There was an anticipation.
Well, that I think is one. Of course, that lives on in the form of the Wimbledon queue every year, where people actually sleep out overnight for their chance to get the day's access tickets and so on. I was going to say, though, that one of my friends likes to talk about he doesn't use the term pre-internet brain, but what he talks about is the capacity for long-form thought that he feels has really vanished. And, you know, one of my friends who runs an organization that has a lot of younger employees says he can't get them to read books, for example.
No, I think that's absolutely true, because I think that the screens and the feeds have subsumed a lot of just the battle for attention, right? So I think that the attention war rages on, and screen time is in my house, there are caps on that, but there are also violations of screen time for having a pre-teenager.
I was going
I've
to
been
say,
busy.
I was going to surmise it was the parents who broke the rules.
Both, actually. I was watching a clinical a psychologist today, researcher, talking about that it happens on both sides.
I had a different thought about pre-internet brain. I was thinking, I mean, from my perspective, kind of the way my mind worked, I was like ready for the internet when it appeared. I had no idea it was coming, but and I had studied McLuhan and the concept of a media matrix and that sort of thing, and just kind of like the idea of networks and information flowing over networks, that was kind of already in my head before I had anything like internet access or before I even started touching computers. And I didn't realize, how do you make that happen? It just seemed like something that it's like almost like I could feel it coming. So that's kind of what I was thinking of.
I would add to that only to say that it would be false nostalgia to claim that we weren't totally on board with network communications at the time. I remember being excited to be on the well at the time. Remember, excited to have to be, have my first email account, or excited to have access to to Usenet, and to see a world of different brains and different kinds of information that was not available on a newsstand or on the radio or television. So I would say that when people say they miss the pre-internet brain, I guess it's not necessarily that they would trade where they are now to go back to 1988 or something. It's a kind of a question of, like, cognitively, are we at the limit of our public health around how much we consume, and how we consume it, and how we process it, and how we then get ways to stay like cognitive health and our well-being.
Yeah, I think I definitely had pre-internet brain, and I tend to intentionally irritate John with my fascination with everything analog. And if I switch over here to
Oh, two cameras, camera
camera
two.
number two in my background there, just a little bit of my vinyl collection, tape collection. I love everything analog, but I spent so much time in digital that. That's kind of why I like analog now. It's my escape when I get tired of my little digital thing that's right in front of me. I like to deal with these things behind me. So I guess that's part of internet brain, but you just kind of have to go for things that help you cope with the world as it is now. And that's one of my reasons for doing that.
I remember John Perry Barlow telling me that after years of soaking in the online world were what had given him a greater appreciation of the physical world. Now, of course, you could never trust what John said, but he was talking.
The greatest salt, at least.
Yeah, but that was what he said at that moment.
Yeah, that sounds like John. So question, well, so what drew you over the years to this field of like metadata and unique identifiers, the kind of thing that you're looking at now? And like, how is all that stuff evolving with AI and immersive media?
I think there is a lineage or progression that can be kind of understood in a way. I was working in the winter of 91 in Foster City, California, before I joined Wired on an interactive television company for a dead media. Bruce Sterling talks about dead media. The dead media of that time was called the the CDI, the Compact Disc Interactive, Philips Interactive Media of America, PIMA, was the Dutch consortium that was funding and trying to prime the pump and jumpstart the consumption of the little interactive CD-ROMs, but they were their own proprietary format from Philips. There was a box to set on top of your TV set. You hooked it to your TV set. You
I
could
remember
have, yeah,
those.
it was like a game controller, like for kids these days, or for like game controllers, like with Xbox and PlayStation, been around for decades. But here's the thing: at that point, there weren't those kind of console games, and there weren't those kinds of CPU horsepower sitting on people's living rooms, dedicated to the big screen in the room. And so, working on interactive TV titles for PF Magic at that point with some video game pioneers was an eye-opening experience. And I then would do that again later in the cable industry for the folks at Time Warner, who did video on demand in Orlando in 1995, I guess, so around there, back when Jim Clark from Silicon Graphics was trying to decide whether to invest in more like television over the internet, over television versus HTML and web, and when he first funded Netscape. So I've seen all these different movies and milestones over the years, and knew that behind the scenes there was always data behind the data, and that's metadata. And even with my interactive TV work at both PF Magic and at Time Warner, we were always dealing in metadata. And then years later, I would get recruited by a friend of mine who was another interactive TV guy, Dave Friesman at Showtime Networks here in New York City, who said, "We need a metadata guru. We need someone to map out the relationships. I'm too busy with interactive television. Will, could you come in and be our director of metadata management and map out from origin points to distribution points, the flow and the supply chain workflow of content metadata?" Because I'd been in distribution and interactive on the cable side over to the television side with Showtime to map out metadata as it is survives. Where does it start? From we literally was like from deal memo to glass was our slogan, because that's where a green light of a project was the kickoff of a accrual and accretion of data around a title or a project or a theatrical. All the captions, synopses, photography, unit photography, box art, all those different things are the data about the program, or the season, the series, the episode, documentaries and specials. I have some good stories there about the reboot of Twin Peaks with David Lynch at his artistic control, but I'll come back to that in a second. But that was part of the journey of like there was this role. No one had ever been the director of metadata management at Showtime. David, to his credit, to my everlasting credit, and thanks for to him, invented the role and the job description at Showtime, and then said, "I think you're the guy to do it." And then after months and months and months and months and months of interviewing and waiting on a decision, they finally said yes. And that would have been the fall of 2014, when I joined up with Showtime Networks here in New York to map those things out and map out those relationships and to see the dark arts of the twisted path of metadata from origin to distribution. And that was part of the story of how it got me to running the Entertainment ID Registry, which is effectively the barcode for the film and TV industry. It's an Emmy award-winning trade association that does that for all the major film studios and television networks. They create a unique identifier for content that's a res object resolution through the DOI Foundation, and that's used as a handle system. But we can go down that path. But we probably don't have time to go down that path. But it's effectively like DNS name resolution. It does object resolution, the DOI handle IDs that are part of the DOI system. So that has been my journey in metadata to where I am now, which is around object resolution of notable people and their connected replicas and fictional characters, which are all under the rubric or the umbrella of talent. and the definition of one's public figures, not private individuals, public figures only. We're identifying them with a unique handle, a DOI ID. So, the thing, a story of the quick anecdote about Showtime and David Lynch, real quick, was that when Twin Peaks came back for the reboot in about 2017 or 20 or 2016, David was really quite concerned that he wanted the synopses, the captions for every episode, to be written only by him and to never be edited. And they were rather cryptic and enigmatic in their writing, and he very much in his style. And when the companies in the industry tried to edit them and add them and change them, he was rather insistent that they not. And so we tried, had to tell people in the industry and in the metadata space, do not edit David Lynch's synopses, please. This is coming directly from him. And they eventually said, okay, if it's five words and that's what David Lynch wants, auteur, Mr. Director, producer, creative genius, that's what we get. And so often there'd be three to five word descriptions of each episode, which was fun
It
to
was,
try to also help him with his vision on that.
sounds like a precursor of the Mad Men synopses, which were also very, they weren't quite as short as that, but they were very, very cryptic, and nobody could tell from them what was going to happen in the episode.
Perhaps, yeah. I've seen it go both ways, where they're poorly written, cryptically written, or verbosely written. That is metadata about programming. That synopsis is effectively part of the metadata workflow and supply chain of the industry.
I get it. He saw the metadata as being part of the overall art object, right? You couldn't really separate it.
The tease. Yeah.
So exactly what does the company do? I mean, you have metadata for, like, you have a sort of metadata, what, descriptor for a famous person? Is this a way to track? I mean, does this relate to, like, AI representations of those people in some
I
way?
can't. Well, I can't. Moreover, the notion that legal and natural people, as recently as last September, who are happen to be in the often actors, often people in California and Hollywood, are now protected by a law that Governor Gavin Newsom signed, that in the world of deepfakes, in a time of fraudulent representations and shady dealings, and as recently as February, there was a deepfake of Tom Hanks still selling diabetes tears as YouTube pre-roll ads, and he's also been selling dental plans, if you believe your eyes. But he also issued disclaimers to that effect. The threat of deepfakes is the number one thing that is capturing people's attention, and so why does what I do matter as a piece of the solution of the provenance, right, of the source verification of the verifiable credentials of the individual? We provide a free to search and match, persistent, no expiration date, unique identifier to identify the object of the person, and then a parent-child relationship to their replica if they're with their consent. So while there are many companies who've raised quite a lot of money to use AI to detect deepfakes, there are fewer companies engaged in the necessary work around source verification of what is real and what is with consent in a world where fraudsters and scam artists and others have been appropriating, if not fully stealing, people's name, image, and likeness, their NIL, their name, image, and likeness, and sometimes their voice, which is even a more scary and dangerous area for everyone, really. It doesn't matter if it's a celebrity or just or the private individuals. It's a world where the technology and the tools and the voice models are so good that the uncanny valley has been bridged, especially in voice. and that we need protections from both the public and private sector to help people guard against deception and to authorize what is real and what is with consent, and especially if people are going to license their identity in some way. So there is something a little Philip K. Dick about it, I imagine, for this audience who will know what I'm talking about with regards to representation, agency, the cloning of oneself into a digital twin or a digital replica. How will that Wild West, yet again another Wild West, be managed or not, right? Right? Because things can go any one of a dozen different directions, and sometimes in both directions at the same time, because I'm thinking of the croakers and panic culture. I'll throw a reference in there for you too. So that we have a world where there's a best effort and with good faith around trying to set some guardrails around identity. It's a very difficult and thorny area. Right now there's this week going on in Mountain View at the Computer History Museum, the Internet Identity Workshop, which has been going on for many years, twice, two meetings a year. That's got your friend Doc Searles is a part of that community, the Internet Identity Workshop. Some really smart folks get together to talk about what is the nature of the long term, like the SALT talks, the long term thinking, strategic thinking around identity in a world where it hasn't worked out really great in social media, in the rise of social media, for people to trust what they see with their eyes and what they hear with their ears.
When deepfakes first appeared on the scene, it was considered kind of cute and trendy, and people were trying to do it, with various rudimentary apps. And now it's become very serious. You see it involved in phony deepfakes of political figures, important people that are doing important work. You can't be sure if this is real or not. And that seems just to really be more and more of an issue. And do you see any end to that, or is it just going to continue spiraling out of control? But it seems like every time someone comes up with a fix, someone finds a workaround.
I think, John, you know this. We've been around long enough to know, Wendy and Scoop, you know this, that when the cat's out of the bag and Pandora's box is open, it's hard to get things back in the box, if nigh on impossible. I think deepfakes are going to be with us forever, but here's the thing, or at least some variation or permutation of them. And that's not me like trying to sugarcoat it or to be hysterical about it. I think authenticity, agency, and protecting identity is still possible in a world where it looks like it's being eroded or being under attack. Deloitte Consulting issued a report recently saying that in 2023, there were $16 billion in losses from deepfake attacks. And by 2027, they project $40 billion in losses due to deepfake attacks. Now, even if it's half that, it's serious, right? Whether you take the number from 23 or the number from 27. So there's a lot of attention focused on the problem. And there are a lot of smart people thinking about ways to provide guardrails and new models of trust and security. But for all the hundreds of cybersecurity and biometric and digital wallets and multi-factor authentication companies out there, sometimes they're all of those things in one. We're still going to have the threat surface and of multiple threat surfaces.
I've gotten sort of oddly optimistic about this because we have had many times historically new technologies which could fool people. And one of the things that I was thinking about when I had this thought was the magic lantern in Knock in Ireland that convinced people that the Virgin Mary and a couple of saints had visited, you know, and the image was actually projected on the side of a church using an elaborate setup with a mirror and things. And we would never be taken in by that today. And even if deep fakes are indistinguishable from the real thing, the fact that we know that deep fakes are widespread is going to change the equation. It's the availability cognitive bias, that you didn't think of it when it was unknown to you, but when it is known to you, you question things. And so I've decided to be optimistic that we will actually over time become much better at spotting things that are fakes.
I sure hope you're right, Wendy. I feel like that point you make about the historical example, you know, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice. But, or in the words of Debbie, can't get fooled again. So the thing is, we have an opportunity to educate. I wish this country was more like Finland, where they teach media literacy in the fourth grade, where kids are schooled on how to detect bias in what they read, are schooled in trying to get multiple sources and primary sources, there's hopefully going to be, it's going to require education. I think to your point about the person, people not being taken in by what we see now as a cheap magic trick, with the smoke and mirrors, the old saying goes, that there'll be a rising tide to lift up awareness of such things, and then whether it's our friends at the Coalition for Content Provenance and Authenticity, also known as C2PA, with their content credentials, standard cryptographic metadata, watermarking, fingerprinting are the three bronze bullets they describe it as. Because there is no silver bullet, but the three bronze bullets do a pretty good job. They're overlapping and complementary. That systems and methods will be stood up to provide attestations of authenticity about the work or the person within the work or the objects within the work.
The BBC already has something like that.
Yeah, the BBC is very big on that also. I work with those folks through the International Press Telecommunications Council, the IPTC. So I'm a member of both that and the C2PA folks and their work around content credentials. So HAND is a member of these organizations, and our little piece of the puzzle is a free to search and match, persistent, unique identifier that's eminently resolvable forever by design, just like IP address resolution or a barcode. And so to have a piece of the puzzle around an identity signal is what HAND brings to the table.
Let's say you're a recognizable actor. Let's say you're Willem Dafoe, for instance. Somebody decides to make a film and use your likeness in it. And they use AI to construct this likeness, and they do this without your permission. So what are your rights? What can you do in that case? Is that defined?
I think it's interesting to think about, and like I know we're eventually going to have to talk about the OpenAI and Studio Ghibli, but back to if there's a Dafoe bot or a Dafoe clone twin replica used in public in a commercial setting, then there are legal remedies. There are takedown notices. There are there are elements of that, but also, and that's where the hopefully the law enforcement comes into the picture for traceability of the source of the fraud, of the deception. But also under fair use laws, if it was for political purposes or for commentary or for, and it wasn't selling a diabetes cure or a dental plan or purporting to be something that it wasn't, without the consent and the credit control compensation of the individual, then if it's for those purposes of they're covered under fair use, absolutely see that. You seen the one with it was a few months ago. It was Trump and Biden on a motorcycle riding on a road buddy road trip. Political commentary. AI generated images of Joe Biden and Donald Trump in a fanciful set of buddy bonding exercises and eating ice cream together and riding a motorcycle together and things like that. Is it fraud? It's commentary, right? So there's the world is big enough to, I think, contain representation, appropriation of name, image, and likeness for those kind of purposes, and to protect people from usages that are not with their consent.
Yes, if you look on the Plutopia Facebook page, John, my dear partner, has created an AI representation of the two of our faces and heads. And I looked at that when when I first discovered it, and I went, "I've got to talk to John. That doesn't look anything like me." Then I turned to the mirror and went, "Oh, right, never mind." So. So I let him off the hook on that, but that's being done quite a bit these days.
John, can you show the AI version of you and Marcia and I? Do you have that handy? Your cartoonization? You're on mute, John. You are on mute. You're muted, John.
I am working on opening that. I had it opened.
Which tab?
Oh,
One of the
shoot.
tabs. It's one of these tabs. Somewhere here. Under
No,
the
it's
cool.
just the problem I'm having is that I set it full screen, but it won't share as full screen.
Oh, then you have to do the swipe to the right or the left. And sometimes
Oh, there it is. Sorry about that. There we go.
Okay, so here we are. There we go.
And that was not set up as a Studio Ghibli sort of style, but it is kind of similar to it. It was just set up as a comic book style. Now I can sh
To
show
show the
you.
original photo that was based on. But
Oh yeah, I should, let's see
don't
if
have to
I can
go
find
down the
that.
rabbit hole of navel gazing, but that was, I laughed when I saw it. Okay.
I'm trying to find the original photo. Give me a second here. There we
It all.
go.
Okay, wow.
I think this is it. Okay.
One of those. This was at South by
Give me
Southwest.
a sec here. Yeah, we were at
Another
South
was
by Southwest,
early March, from
and
March
it was
9th.
early March, and we
Waiting
were
in
on
line. Actually,
Congress. There we are.
there
This
we
is it.
go. We just seen the Curtis Mayfield documentary at the Paramount.
That's right. That's
Which
right.
was awesome. All of us big fans of the legendary Curtis Mayfield.
Indeed, indeed.
And
I have something else to show too. We were talking about in the more in the style of Studio Ghibli. Let's see if I can share this one. So this was taken from a photo where I had introduced Bruce Sterling during South by Southwest. So
Oh.
that's me. Marcia says I shouldn't show this to anybody. She doesn't think it looks like me.
No, the other one looks
But
more like me. Yeah. But the badge tracks.
And then, of course, there's that shot of Scoop and I. I wonder if I can find that.
I think it we are in a time where, with Wendy's optimism, thank you for sharing that, Wendy. I mean that. That the tools that are being made available and the questions around the training data, what these AI large and small language models are being trained on, will hopefully get sorted as to what's the model from a licensing perspective, what's the model from a rights perspective. Oh, that's definitely studio. It's really style.
Yeah, that's Studio Ghibli style for sure.
It's interesting because that doesn't really look like Scoop, and yet it captures one of his expressions very well.
Yeah.
Actually, it does kind of, yeah, I'm actually manipulating my image now. So this isn't really how I look. I think John captured me pretty well.
I think Zoom can give you bushier eyebrows if you in a that I think that there's some different ways that one can enhance their filters for their look, among other things. So, but yeah, we're here. AI is here. It's not going away. What's going to be the narrative? What's going to be the way that artists will be respected? I hope. Because it's an interesting time, a moment in time.
You know, I wanted to surmise that one of the reasons they have such good media literacy in Finland is that Russia is so close by and they've been attacked many times. And I think one of the problems in the States in particular is that the misinformation is coming from the top.
Calls coming from within the building.
Yeah. And so,
part of the problem within the States is that you have certain people in power who believe that we're better off if we don't have media literacy, if we're not literate, if we're not able to think for ourselves.
I like Wendy's point about like Pravda and TASS being just across the border in Russia. From the Soviet era, especially Finland, quite cognizant of that. Being a Western democracy, recent member of the NATO club. I think that the polarization in America has us thinking, half of us thinking there is no propaganda and there is no copy, and that the other half thinking there is. Maybe it's not that simplistic or cut and dried, or that it's always the other side that is weaponizing information versus their side. And that's the unfortunate world we've gotten ourselves into.
Yeah, I'm pretty messed up. I see propaganda on both sides.
You know, the Finns to come over here and help us out. A Finnish invasion.
There's propaganda and there's propaganda. I mean, I think when one side denies significantly less science than the other.
Right.
And I'm always going to be on the side of, you know, scientific evidence.
Yeah, thankfully.
Well, I mean, I see this a lot. And, you know, I'm in a lot of conversations all day, every day. I'm talking to people online. And I can't tell you how many times I've become like a fact checker. Mm-hmm. Because there's just so much shit in the air. Huh?
John, you're just like the one-man Snopes.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of shit in the air. There's a lot of belief and contention in the air. And people that I know and respect, who I consider to be smart people, are picking up on things that are actually inaccurate and sometimes subtly inaccurate. And they're just kind of not thinking it through, you know, or they're not really looking. They don't go and look for sources. They don't look for the sources of the stories that they're hearing and kind of tracing those back and seeing whether what they heard was accurate or whether it was sort of like the telephone game, the thing where, you know, you tell somebody something, they tell somebody else, and eventually the story changes. There's a lot of that stuff going on. Yeah.
Well, that's why we had, first Trump White House was the alternative facts lady getting up on camera saying alternative facts, and the question of like, are everyone entitled to their own set of facts? Well, then I guess they're not facts anymore, are they? If everyone has their own facts,
well, it's a different interpretation of what fact means, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, the epistemological crisis,
and brains do weird stuff with perception.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe, so, and this goes back to what our first point, the pre-internet brain, right? Maybe part of the question there is, has the internet and digital communications and the tsunami of it changed our cognitive capacity to let in more noise from signal, more distortion from clean, the higher fidelity information.
Yeah. Well, so we're down to our last 5 minutes or so, a little less than 5 minutes. And my question for you is, where is all this going? What is the future of this stuff? What about these AI, we're referring to them as deep fakes, but basically a creation that is seemingly very real, but absolutely, constructed in bits and bytes. How can you apply something like a watermark to that?
Mm-hmm. Well, you can. If it's a composite of tokenized information from thousands of sources, training the language model trained on, and it spews it out into a synthetic person, the contract credentials, cryptographic metadata can be attached to a watermark or have a fingerprinting process. That standard has been adopted by Adobe and OpenAI and a few others, and to say this is made with artificial intelligence, made with AI, right? As part of an ingredient label that when you click on the little logo in the upper left corner, it then does a drop down or pop up and says was made with AI or was made with a Nikon camera that had a chipset that is following the contract credential standard. And it's actually the chain of custody and chain of trust has, to the best of their knowledge, not been broken or compromised through its origin story across every different part of the chain of the media flow to your monitor or your nice beach background somewhere in the tropics.
But on our unauthorized Willem Dafoe, is there going to be a point where Willem Dafoe could point to that and say, that's not me, and I can prove that it's not, because it wasn't authorized because it lacks the metadata to show that it was authorized.
Well, right, Trump has told us many, many times that he didn't know people, and the fact that there's always a photograph of him with those people is, irrelevant, right?
Epstein and I, we'd never met. Jeffrey, never done. But Ghislaine, though, she was one of his favorites over that one. That's also what Amnesty and Witness and other organizations talk about. And people would say, I remember years ago, Peter Gabriel would get up a photo of the car, like, a photograph doesn't lie. Oh, that's not so true anymore. Photographs can lie.
But it was never true. I mean, if you go back to the 19th century when photography was new, you had all these spirit photographs of, ectoplasm coming out of mediums' mouths and spirits in photographs of dead, who looked like dead relatives. I mean, we can look at them now and say these are obvious fakes.
They were shallow fakes.
But at the time, it was really mysterious.
I thought those were real.
Sure you did.
The medium and the spiritualists of the late 1800s. I think it's a great example, right? With every new technology, there's a certain amount of subterfuge that comes with it.
There's two classes of people that jump on new technology right away. One is people who want to sell sex.
Yeah.
And the other is criminals.
Yeah.
You know, I had an interesting
sex and crime. The crossroads of sex and crimes.
So I avoided TikTok for a long time, but when I finally started looking at TikTok, I found that every other video I saw on TikTok was of a sea monster. And I thought, wow, they're sure finding a lot of sea monsters. It turns out sea monsters are, I guess, sort of easy to build with the sort of simpler CGI apps that are available now. It's amazing.
Yeah,
the effects were amazing.
I've seen a lot of weird effects on TikTok as well. They have a lot of not very convincing UFO footage that they keep posting.
I mostly see TikTok when other people post it to Mastodon or Blue Sky or something. But my favorite was the woman who has a license to rehabilitate wild animals and had this beaver living in her house while his broken leg repaired itself. And the beaver was wandering all over the house, building dams out of anything he could find and blocking up doorways. The videos were hilarious.
Now, was that a deep fake or was that real?
No, it was real. It was actually real. That is what beavers do. They build dams, and if they have to build them out of old shoes and coat hangers, that's what they build them out of.
Yeah, leave it to beaver.
Evolution to tell the beaver what to do.
We have actually run out of time, and I think we could probably keep talking for hours, but that means we'd like to invite you back sometime if you want to join us again.
Thanks, John. I'd love to come back.
I'm going to grab my surfboard and head out to the beach, which is right there. And it's totally real.
Do show me on a map sometime where you found a beach in Austin, Texas.
No, it's out in Bastrop.
Yes.
Where the break is.
Yeah, Bastrop actually has a beachfront property for sale. I'll be glad to sell you some.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Wendy, Scoop, John.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for @Plutopia News. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.